This is World Cafe. I'm Raina Duris. You might not know the names Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis right away, but you've almost definitely heard their work. The songwriting and production duo are behind a ton of R&B hits starting in the 80s. They co-wrote and produced Janet Jackson's 1986 breakthrough album Control. They've had hits with Usher, Boyz II Men, Mariah Carey, Mary J. Blige. The list goes on and on and on. Oh, and before that, they used to play with a little-known artist named Prince. Ring a bell? Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis worked closely with Prince as members of the band The Time, until they didn't. And that story is just one of the many you're about to hear from Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And we will dig into the very first album the two of them have released together under their own names, an album decades in the making, Jam and Lewis Volume 1. Let's kick things off with a track from that album. This song features Mariah Carey, one of the many guests featured on the record. Here is Somewhat Loved, There You Go, Breaking My Heart.
Breaking my heart.
You just heard Somewhat Loved, There You Go, Breaking My Heart, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis featuring Mariah Carey on vocals. That's from the new album Jam and Lewis Volume 1. And today, I'm joined by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Welcome to the World Cafe.
Thanks, Randa. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Now, just so listeners know whose voice is whose, could you each introduce yourselves, say your name? Jimmy, maybe you can go first.
Okay. Hey, everybody. I'm Jimmy Jam.
And I'm Terry Lewis.
This is your debut album as Jam and Lewis, but you are joined by a whole bunch of guests, people you've worked with before, like Mariah Carey, and you have worked with so many people. Jimmy, maybe you can answer this question. There are only 10 songs on this album, so how did you decide which artists you wanted to work with the first time that you're putting music out under your own names?
Well, we some of it was decided for us, but we basically put a wish list together, a pretty long one, actually. And these were the artists that were interested and available. I guess that has a lot to do with it. And so we were very happy with the results. But part of the reason that we call the album Volume 1 is because we plan on doing a Volume 2 and a Volume 3. And, you know, we're just going to keep going, hopefully. But yeah, we just really put together, we got the people that we really wanted to work with that inspired songs, inspired really us to do what we think is our best work. And that was really the prerequisite of the wish list. So it's turned out really well for us.
Mm-hmm. As producers and musicians, the two of you are responsible for so much of that R&B sound that got really popular in the late 80s and the 90s. And that comes through on this album, but it also does sound like something new. Terry, what did you guys do to keep things fresh while still familiar?
Well, working with the classic artists that we've worked with, I mean, these are voices that you've known pretty much over the last couple of decades, and probably before that, some of them. It just keeps it very familiar to you. But we tried to write songs that we felt were the songs that were best suited for these particular artists in today's world. COVID forced us to be remote. We had to do things differently. So it changed kind of your attitude towards production. And, you know, the result is what you hear. And I think it came out pretty well.
So you would figure out what artist you wanted to write the song for first. So you would write the song for that artist? You wouldn't write a song and then ask an artist to be on it?
No. We generally tailor. I think there's been very few times that we've recorded things previously and then put them on artists. You know, it's like a tailored suit. We like to be somewhat tailors. We like to let you choose your own fabric and texture. And, you know, the thread we use is always the same. The stitch is, you know, pretty much the same. But, you know, the artist's input is everything for us.
It's bespoke.
Totally.
In 1994, you did the song On Bended Knee with Boyz II Men, which was a big hit. It sounds like this.
Can you tell me how a perfect love goes
Now, they're back with you on this new album, too, for the song The Next Best Day. Obviously, COVID changed things, but how were things different this time around? It's an artist you've worked with before, and now they're singing on your album. How does that change things?
They got to do what we say. It only changes it in that our intent is really to make the best music that we can possibly do. And it probably sounds almost cliche to say, but the way I put it is like this is Terry always says there's really three kinds of music. There's good music, there's bad music, and there's hits. You can't really, you can argue the first two, good and bad, that's subjective. If it's a hit, it's a hit. Mm-hmm. We really don't make hits, meaning that me and Terry, we don't make hits. What we try to do is make good music. And then it's really up to a whole lot of factors, you know, people playing it on the radio, people, you know, streaming it, talking about it. And there's so many things that go into it to make an actual hit record. So our thing is, let's just try to make it as good as we can possibly do it. So having, you know, obviously Bended Knee, which was a big record for us, Four Seasons of Loneliness, which was another big record with us, and Boyz II Men, we kind of know the ingredients that we put into those songs that we feel make the Boyz II Men that you want to hear, at least that we want to hear. We're kind of selfish about it. We just make the records we want to hear at this point. And without any, I hate to use the word record company interference, but that's what I always come up with. I can't think of a better way to say it. Without a record company telling you this or analytics or any of those types of things, let's just go make a great songs. We knew that Boyz II Men really were into great lyrics. They were into chord changes. They were into, I remember Nate from Boyz II Men called us and said, hey man, can we put real strings on it? It's like, yeah, yeah. And then Sean from Boyz II Men came to the string session. You know, it's like the things that excite them about music, that's what we want them to be excited about. And that's what we tried to put into The Next Best Day, which is the song from our album. And I remember the coolest thing about this was when Sean came to the studio one day for a whole different reason. And he wanted to hear the mix of the song. We had him listen to the immersive audio version of the song. And when he heard it, he just cried. And what he was trying, what the reason he cried was because he was hearing all the things that growing up were important to him about music. He was hearing, but then he was hearing himself on that song. And then his mind was flashing back to Bended Knee, and he was flashing back to all these different things. And he said, I hope people get this. I hope people understand this. And I said, I think they will. Because if you get it and we get it, then that means other people will get it too, you know? Yeah. So it's, but Boyz II Men is so inspiring, man.
I think people will get it. We're going to hear it right now. So if you're listening, I hope you get this. It's Boyz II Men, The Next Best Day with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis.
All apart, tomorrow's the next best day, so we celebrate the love we have, through the good times and the bad. Today is the most precious day of my life,
tomorrow's the next best day.
From Jam and Lewis, Volume 1, that was Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, joined by Boyz II Men for The Next Best Day. Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis are my guests today on World Cafe. I read in an interview, Terry, you said you have a great time when you record, the two of you. So could you take us into the studio with you? Say I'm recording an album with you, aside from maybe suggesting that I get singing lessons. What do we do? What would happen? What is it like recording with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis?
Well, Brenda, it would be the greatest time of your life. first, we're going to start out by just having fun, just sitting around, having conversations, probably having a bite to eat, you know, and just learning about who you are, because that's the most important thing. We would just chill out and really get into you and figure out what your voice is. What do you want to talk about? What are the things that you want to express?
Tony Braxton has said that you guys are like therapists. Would you say that's a description that fits?
That's a big part of it.
Somewhat.
That's a big, because therapists only in the sense is that trust is so important. It's one of the biggest keys to working with somebody is that you have to have, they have, the artist has to trust you and feel like they're in good hands, so to speak. Like they're, you know, and so they're not afraid to sing out of key, or they're not afraid to give you ideas or whatever. So you want to make sure that they're very comfortable. So in that sense, yeah, it's probably, I would say it's probably the most intimate relationship you can have with a person besides, you know, if they're your friend or your wife or whatever that relationship is. That's what an artist and producer collaboration is like. And then you then in learning them can figure out the things they like to do as far as, do they like it, you know, dark in the studio? Do they like, you know, candles? Do they like whatever? Do they like it bright? Some people respond better when there's an audience, you know, when there's like an entourage of people around, that's when they perform the best or whatever. Some people like it very intimate, and sometimes it'll just be myself or it'll just be Terry rather than the two of us. So all of those things you kind of figure out. So it's a little bit of psychology and a little bit of psychiatry. And all of that goes into it. At the end of the day, our job is really to get the best performance out of the artist. So whatever that takes, sometimes for Terry, Terry's a great cook. So sometimes it's a come over to the house and let me cook up some chicken for you, or, you know, or some chili, you know, turkey chili. Terry makes the best turkey chili ever. So sometimes it's that kind of thing. It's knowing when the artist, some days they come to the studio and you just know it's just not that day where they're going to get, you know, and so we just hang out or we go see a movie or we, you know, whatever. It's just kind of figuring all those things out. It's important.
Is there a session that sticks out to you from over your career where you were trying to record a song and you ended up, you know, getting really deep and getting something out of it where you were like, this is magic. Like we did it like this. You couldn't believe maybe that you got that performance.
Wow. That's a great question. Hmm. I don't know if anybody's ever asked that question before.
No, that's a new one.
Yeah. That's a good one.
I would think there were, well, many wonderful sessions in our career, but there are two. I'll do one of them, most impactful sessions, and the first one was Patty Austin, and she came in and she flew into town, and we thought we were prepared. Like, you know, as producers, we always try to study the artist, the history, where the music came from. And Patty was a Quincy Jones artist. And so we definitely wanted to be on our best behavior and do our best work for Quincy, because Q is like our mentor. Bow down to Q. All right. So we studied. We did everything. We had the songs ready, we thought. And Patty came. She flew in, came directly to the studio and said, okay. So we said, oh, yeah, well, we'll get together tomorrow and we'll do these songs. And she said, no, let me hear what you got. And so we played the song and she said, okay, give me the lyrics. And she went in the booth and she sang the song back that we had just given her a demo of perfectly. Pitch, pronunciation, feeling, everything was perfect. And we said, okay. She said, should I do it again? Yeah. Okay. So she did it again and we were done with that song. She said, what's next? So we pulled up the second song and she did the same thing again. And we had a third song, but it wasn't ready. So we had to send her home because we were not prepared, because she could have just knocked it all out in one night. So it just showed us as prepared as we think we were, and as well-versed and studied as we thought we were, it wasn't that fact. The fact was is that we were ill-prepared and she was prepared for anything. So we knew at that point, okay, we had to get better. And the second one was Michael Jackson. I'll let Jimmy tell that story because he tells that story so much better than I.
I don't know about that. But yeah, when you talk about impactful session, so to set it up a little bit, we had been asked, Michael had called us and asked, would we do a song with him and Janet together? And we go to the studio, we play him all the tracks that we have. And he goes, okay, I think I really like track number 2 or whatever. And Janet looked at me like, that told you that's the one he was going to like. And it's like, okay, cool, Michael. So that track ended up becoming Scream. And we wrote the song actually in his apartment. And he had the whole lyric idea and the whole, he knew what exactly what he wanted to say. And so when we go to the studio the next day, the song starts and it's like, he turns into like the Tasmanian devil. Like it's all of a sudden, like it's a full performance. He's spinning and he's doing all his stuff, all his Michael Jackson stuff. Right. And Terry and I, we're like some teenage girls. We're like, it's Michael Jackson. We're forgetting we're supposed to be in there working, right? Whole song goes by, start to finish. When it ends, our jaws are like just on the floor. And now it's just silent. We're not even saying anything. So Michael now goes back to calm Michael and he goes, how was that, guys? We're like, yeah, Mike. Yeah. And he goes, do you want me to try it again? Yeah, Mike, yeah, try it again. Yeah, give it another try. And he goes, okay. Janet's sitting between us. Janet, and remember, we're in New York. Janet leans into us and she just goes, I'll do my vocal in Minneapolis. She wanted no part in following Michael. And of course, Michael ripped off a couple more takes that were just as amazing as those takes. And absolutely the most impactful studio moment we ever had. And then I'll give you the epilogue to the story, as we like to say. We did go to Minneapolis after that and record Janet's vocal. And Janet killed it. She did wonderful, right? We sent that vocal to Michael. And Michael called us and he said, hey, Janet sounds really good. We said, oh, thanks, Michael. He said, yeah, she sounds really good. Where'd she do that vocal? And we said, in Minneapolis. He said, oh. He said, okay, I'm going to come to Minneapolis. So Michael then, because Janet's vocal sounded so good, he wanted to come to Minneapolis, which he did. And we ended up using maybe 10% of what he did in Minneapolis. Most of it we had gotten in New York. But just it showed his competitive nature, even with his sister. It's like, oh, she sounds really good. Now I want to redo my vocal to sound really good, you know. So, but man, it was such a crazy session working with him. What a blessing. And what a, you know, and obviously them together was just such a historical moment to have them together on a record. I'm glad we were a part of that.
Well, now we have to hear it. We got to hear Scream, Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson on World Cafe. Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson with Scream on World Cafe. That song produced by my guests today, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. This is World Cafe. I'm Raina Duris. Let's go back to the beginning. You met when you were both in junior high school in the early 70s. Terry, what was your first impression of Jimmy?
Well, my first recollection of seeing Jimmy and even understanding that he did music was he was in the lunchroom. And this was a summer school program. So all the pianos and everything from around the school were in this lunchroom. And Jimmy was in the lunchroom with a bunch of girls around the piano playing and swooning the girls. Oh, no. And I saw that. I said, oh, this dude is kind of cool. So at that time, I had just got into, playing with my friends because we were all athletes. And at the end of this summer program, Upper Bound, they were going to have a dance. So we wanted to play like a little set of music live, and we needed a keyboard player. So after I met Jam, I found out that he was actually a drummer, and he wasn't a keyboard player, but he knew how to play keyboard. So we had to convince him to play keyboards. And his father was a keyboardist and artist. So we had to go steal his father's keyboard, and that was our first gig that we played together. And that was the beginning of our musical relationship.
And so Jimmy, was that true? Were you wooing girls with the piano in the lunchroom?
I remember the piano in the lunchroom. The wooing the girls part, I don't really know. Although I definitely had a couple go-to songs back in the day. I remember "Color My World" by Chicago was one of my songs that I'd always play that people seemed to enjoy. You know, and some of them happen to be ladies for sure. So he's probably right in that recollection.
Once you started playing together, what was the music scene like for you in Minneapolis, like right when you were starting out?
Very competitive.
Yeah.
Very competitive. There was a lot of really great bands up there and a lot of musical talent. And it was a very small, I mean, the population, at least the black population of Minnesota at that time, or Minneapolis at that time, was very small, maybe 3%, 5% black or something like that. So we would all end up in the same places. You know, Prince had a band that Morris Day was the drummer in, right? I had a band at one point in time, separate from Terry, that was like a singing group type band. It just was singers and that kind of thing. Terry had Flight Time, which was, you know, his group. And then there was all these other really competitive groups. And it was kind of like in the movie Purple Rain. There's a thing that happens in Purple Rain where, you know, they say in the club, there's only like one club that everybody wants to play at, but there's, you know, three spots for a band, but there's four bands. And that was the way it was in Minneapolis. You had to be one of the best bands or you couldn't get a gig, and you couldn't play in the white clubs because they wouldn't allow. They wanted R&B music. They just didn't want black people to play R&B music. Right. So we grew up in those kind of conditions, you know, so we knew all the competition. And the whole battle of the bands, like right now, there's a big, you know, versus is what everybody's talking about. We grew up, our versus was for real. And even the adversity of not being able to play in the clubs, in the white clubs, turned us into entrepreneurs, because what it did was we would then put out flyers, do our own gigs. We rented this hotel ballroom in this hotel that was about to be torn down. But we drew like 1,500 people the first night that we did a show. And everybody in the clubs are sitting empty, and everybody's like, where's everybody at? And they're like, well, they're watching the band that you wouldn't let play at your club. But what it did was it put us on a direction of, it wasn't enough to just have talent. We also had to figure out how to get our talent out there. So we always would save all our money, do demo tapes and do stuff. And then when Prince got his major deal with Warner Brothers, that's when we knew we need to set our sights on national, not just staying local, but what we could do nationally.
Yeah.
And it really changed the direction of everything that we did.
Jimmy, is it true that you went to junior high school with Prince?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we met in junior high. We took a piano class together. We both already knew how to play, but we took a piano class where the teacher would literally give us Mary Had a Little Lamb or London Bridge or something like that to learn to play the sheet music. And then when the teacher would leave, we'd put on headphones and they had these keyboards and stuff, and we just jammed. And I thought I was a pretty good keyboard player at that point in time, but Prince could play Rings Around Me.
I'm speaking with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis today on World Cafe. You both worked closely with Prince while you were in the band The Time. That was before you really became a production duo on your own and really blew up with that, which we're going to talk about in a bit. But being in The Time, we're going to hear a song from The Time in a second. What did you learn from that experience? Terry, do you want to take that?
Work ethic. How to work. One thing that you could be around Prince and get full time was this guy never slept. He would come to our practice as The Time, and he would be there. We'd be there 6 to 8 hours. He would be there in our rehearsal. He would leave there and go rehearse his band 6 to 8 hours. He would go home, and the next day he would show up with 1999 and say, listen to what I did last night. This guy was relentless. And so what you learned from him was that you had to put in the work. It was a full-time thing. You had to live it, breathe it. And then the other thing that you had to do is also in your persona. You had to live and breathe your persona. You couldn't walk around in gym clothes and then all of a sudden be the artist that you needed to be visually. You had to be that artist all the time, because he was never not Prince. He had on his high heels and his blouses all the time. So that those are some of the two biggest takeaways that you'd get from him.
I can confirm for people who are hearing this on the radio who can't see you guys that you did come in your black turtlenecks, sunglasses, and black hat. So you are living that. You don't break character. I love it. We are going to listen to The Time, 777-9311. This is World Cafe.
Baby, what's your phone number? How can you be reached on a lonely night? Baby, what's your phone number? How can I get into you when I'm feeling right? 777-9311. I want to spend the night with you if that's all right. 777-9311.
The Time with 777-9311 on World Cafe. I'm speaking to Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who were members of The Time, but it was right after Prince fired you both from The Time that you really found big, big success as producers. Can you tell us about working on the SOS band's Just Be Good to Me?
Well, that's a great, kind of story because SOS band was what we were working on when, you know, the reason we got fired was we'd gone to Atlanta to work on the SOS band and we got caught in a snowstorm in Atlanta. And by the way, by snowstorm, this was maybe what in Minneapolis we would call a dusting of snow, meaning you could just sweep it off. You didn't even need a snow shovel, right? But they closed the Atlanta airport. So we were unable to get from Atlanta to our next Time concert, which was in San Antonio. Now, Prince thought we had gone down there to see some girls. So he thought that was funny and he fined us some money. And he said, that's what you get for going to see girls. So it was like, okay, cool. But then later on, there was a picture of us in Billboard magazine of us working with the SOS band. And we went around and tried to hide every Billboard magazine. This is before the internet. So right. Prince was like, where's my billboard? Where's my billboard? And we kept hiding it. But finally, of course, he saw it. So fast forward to that summer. And we now were getting ready to mix what we had done with the SOS band. And that particular day, Prince called and said, meet me at Sunset Sound. And we said, okay, cool. So it wasn't even a decision. It was like, well, are we going to go mix the SOS? Or are we going to go meet Prince? Well, of course we're going to meet Prince. That was our gig, right? So we go to Sunset Sound. Prince, we go in this little room. And Prince says, I told you guys not to produce other acts, but you did. And you're fired. And we're like, what are you talking about? So anyway, I got up and left. I was like, okay, cool. Terry stayed in there, tried to reason with him a little bit. And eventually Terry came out. So we looked at each other and we said, well, what do you want to do? And we said, well, we might as well go mix the SOS band record. So we go to this studio called Larrabee. And the engineer is a guy named Steve Hodge. Now, we had never met Steve before. We had talked to him on the phone, I think, and said, hey, we'd like you to mix our record. And the only reason we knew that record was because we saw his name on a bunch of records we liked on the liner notes of records back in the liner notes days. So we knew we wanted Steve Hodge to mix our record, right? So anyway, we walk in. He goes, hey, nice to meet you guys. What's wrong? And we said, oh, we just got fired from The Time. And he said, oh, wow. He said, well, he said, I don't think you guys got anything to worry about because this record here, this is a smash. And he hit play. And the mix of Just Be Good to Me came on. And it came on with the drums at the beginning. It came on. And we were like, oh, man. And he was right. It was a hit. It was our first big hit record, Just Be Good to Me, SOS band. So it all worked out very, very Hollywood, I guess you could say, in a way.
And I'd like to just reclassify. I hate to say he fired us. I say he freed us. Because I think it's just in how you think about it, because our destiny was, I think, already set for us. And, you know, he just freed us and allowed us to pursue our destiny, because as it came back around, he was very proud of us and we were very cool as friends. So, you know, it's that brotherly relationship.
Yeah, yeah. There was no bad blood after. Ultimately.
No, not, for a while, though. I can't say it wasn't for a while.
Sure.
but it all healed up, and when the scab fell off, I mean, it was all good.
Well, let's hear Just Be Good to Me, the SOS band, World Cafe. We'll be right back. It's World Cafe. I'm joined by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who produced that song by SOS Band called Just Be Good to Me. That song comes out in 1983, becomes your first big hit as producers. And then in the decades since then, you've worked with tons of artists on tons of other hits. Now, it's about 40 years after you first started making music together, and you've released your debut album. And I love that you've released your debut album 40 years in. And we're talking about it today. It's called Jam & Lewis Volume 1. It might seem like a long time to wait for a debut, but I know you started working on a Jam & Lewis album way back in the 80s that you never finished. What happened to that record?
Yeah, we had started working on a record, a Jam & Lewis album back in the day. And around the time that we were, right before we did Control with Janet, as a matter of fact, we kind of put everything on hold because when we got the call to do Janet, we were like, well, let's do that. So we started working on Janet's album. We got the album, what we thought, totally done. And so John McClain, who was the A&R person at A&M Records, he came up to Minneapolis to listen to what we were doing. And we played him Control and Nasty and When I Think of You and Pleasure Principle and Let's Wait a While. Like, we play all these songs for him. And we figure we're good. And like all A&R people would do, he said, yeah, it sounds really good. I just need one more. So what are you talking about, one more? He said, I just need one more. We said, no, man, forget it. Well, you got enough. So we get in the car. Terry puts in a cassette of our songs. And he goes, listen to this, John. This is some stuff from our album that we're going to do. About the third song in, John goes, oh, that's the one I need for Janet. We said, what are you talking about? He said, man, play that for Janet. If she likes it, she can have it. I'm like, what are you talking about? You're just giving away our songs? He said, what are you talking about? He said, no, no, play it for us. So the next day we go to the studio and Janet walks in and we don't even tell her we're going to play anything. We just put it on. And we just kind of watched her. First, she was sitting on the couch and she's kind of grooving. And she walks to the doorway of the studio and she's kind of grooving. She looks at the speakers and points at the speakers and she points at us. The song goes off, just a track at this point. It goes off and she says, who's that for? And we said, well, you if you want it. And she said, oh, I want it. That song became What Have You Done For Me Lately? So it ended up being the song that launched her career and ended ours, at least our album at that point in time. And so it's taken us 35 years. That was 35 years ago. It's taken us that long to finally get selfish to keep our own music.
We're going to come back and hear another song from the new album in a minute. But first, I think we got to hear Janet Jackson, What Have You Done For Me Lately?
Yes.
Janet Jackson's breakout 1986 album Control, that was What Have You Done For Me Lately, co-written and produced by my guests today, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who've just released their own new album called Jam & Lewis Volume 1. Before we get back into the new record, you know, you did work with Janet a ton. When you have so much success with so many hits with Janet, with other people, you know, that's a great thing, of course. But it also comes with an added pressure, I would imagine, to keep making hits. People come to you and they expect something, right? Did you feel that? How did you deal with that kind of pressure?
I don't think we ever felt pressure. I just think we work with amazing people. And it's more about the inspiration. Certainly, we know how to do it with the know-how. You know, you have so many bars of this and so many bars of that. And, you know, you write some lyrics and you make it funky, whatever. But when you get such great artists to work with, you get a whole different level of inspiration, which then propels you to do your best work, you know. And then when you add their parts into it, it just makes it, you know, a great product. Everybody makes hits. That's what I always say. You know, it's not just us. We just make music. And then it takes the radio to play it. It takes the marketing people to get it out there. It takes the people to consume it and love it. And that's what makes it a hit. In the studio, we'll say stuff, oh, yeah, that's a smash. But it's not a smash until the people decide.
It's a smash to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, our theory has always been we do what we think is good, and then we just hope everybody agrees with us, you know, and luckily people have agreed with us over the years. On the pressure thing, too, the other piece of it is I remember when Janet, following up, you know, as you follow up each album, I remember when we got to the Janet album and there was a bunch of, at the time, a bunch of press because she had done a new deal with Virgin Records, and it was the most biggest deal ever that an artist had done in this whole thing. But the interesting thing about it is that as you're making the record in the studio, I think it's the same. My analogy back in the day, I always used to say it's like a baseball player. It's like you can pay a baseball player a ton of money, but when he's trying to hit a curveball or a fastball, he's not thinking about, oh, man, I got this much money in the bank or I'm trying to whatever. He's like, I'm trying to get a hit. I'm just trying to get on base.
Totally.
And that was the way in the studio. There was never any conversation about the biggest deal or money or contracts or anything. That the studio was always the safe space where none of that came into it. It was just about trying to make the best music we could possibly make. So if anything, maybe outside of the studio, we felt pressure. But when we went in the studio, it was all about just making great music. And really, the pressure, I guess, would be the pressure we put on ourselves to try to get better at what we do, not what the outside expectation is.
It also seems like you just had a lot of fun. And I want to finish things off with the last song on your new record, which features The Roots, sees you reuniting with Morris Day from The Time, as well as Jerome Benton, also part of The Time, and Terry, your brother as well.
Yes.
It sounds like you guys are having the best time. What can you tell us about making the song Baby Love?
Fun. Well, you don't have funk without the fun, right?
That's
you gotta,
right.
You gotta have that.
Yeah, you take the fun out of funk. You just had to cut.
Yeah, that's right. And remember if the good old days are the good old days to you, it'll definitely help you remember the good old days, but it will help you celebrate the good new days.
You can't spell funk without fun. I love it. This is Baby Love, Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, Morris Day, Jerome Benton, and The Roots on World Cafe.
Here we go. Girls are sure not fine.
Light them up.
Don't come acting juvenile. It's just a waste of time.
I'm gonna pass up on your hips.
It's enough to get it on. Long as you're 21, I can be your sugar daddy. You can be my baby love.
This is gonna be the sweetest experience of your life.
Were you dancing? I know you were. That was Baby Love, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. I was dancing. That also featured Jerome Benton, Morris Day and The Roots. It is from the new album Jam and Lewis, Volume 1. Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis have been my guests today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Raina.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
It's been great talking to you. I'm Raina Duras, back in a moment with more on World Cafe.